And we've got Derek Jensen on the line. He is often hailed as the philosopher poet of the ecological movement, and he is author of many books. The newest is called Endgame, and it's a two-part book. He's also written Language Older Than Words, Welcome to the Machine, and Culture of Make-Believe, among other books, and we're very excited to have him here with us. Hello, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, one thing I was kind of wondering is, why did you put your new book, Endgame, into two parts, or two volumes?
That's a decision that's made by the publisher, basically, because if you get a book that's that big, the bindings start to fall apart.
Okay.
And also it ends up so expensive that nobody can buy it. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, it's a pretty interesting thing. The truth is, I don't even break the books into chapters, and that's the very last thing I do. I write it as one continuous document, essentially, and the only reason I break it at all is just for convenience sake of using a large document, and also in case a document disappears, then I won't lose the whole book. But I actually don't break into chapters, and I felt kind of weird about that until I was reading some book on writing mysteries, oddly enough, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and there was some famous mystery writer saying, oh, of course, chapters are only for readers. The writers, no writers ever break books into chapters when they write them, and I don't know if that's true, but it sure made me feel a little bit better. Anyway, so there's no reason it was broken into two volumes. And the one thing, when they said they wanted to break it into two volumes, I said, the one condition that's really, fine, I don't care how you do that, but the one condition I put on that is that I wanted to be clear that I wasn't going to write a conclusion to the first one or a preface to the second one, and I wasn't going to mess them around to make them standalone, because I wrote it as one book. And so it's very clear that it's two volumes, two parts of one book, broken for convenience.
So maybe you could sort of summarize what it's about, if that's possible.
In the sort of short version is that this culture, the dominant culture, is killing the planet. This culture is, this culture and life cannot survive. You can't have a culture based on systematic exploitation and expect that to, you can't destroy a planet and live on it. I mean, that's sort of the part of it is that. And we are living in the midst of an environmental apocalypse. It's not like so many people are so eager to say that we have 10 years to turn it around. It's like, no, we're in the midst of it. I mean, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. Phytoplankton populations are collapsing. A few years ago, I began to feel really apocalyptic, but I didn't want to use that word. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so, like, what's it going to take for you to finally call it an apocalypse? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so thick that people are afraid to put their boats in the water because they capsize? Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons that were so large they darkened the sky for days at a time. But if you know why there's no penguins in the northern hemisphere, because this culture eradicated them. There used to be penguins up here. They were called great auks, A-U-K. And there were so many that one French explorer said that you could fill, even on one island, you could fill every ship in France with the birds, and it wouldn't make a dent. And, of course, they did, and it did. Hmm. And, there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk. There's flame retardant in every mother's breast milk. And this is all over the world. And there's more, what is it, six times? I don't remember the number. There's like six times or 10 times more plastic in the ocean than phytoplankton at this point. At what point? Give me a threshold. This is what a friend of mine said to me. Give me a threshold at which you're finally going to use that word. Right? And then that's part of what, that's part of where the book starts. And then another part of where it starts is that I ask people, all over the country at talks and everything else, on buses, everywhere, I ask people, do you believe that this culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And of course, nobody ever says yes. Except once in a while, some passover. Anyway, for the most part, nobody ever says yes. Almost everybody says no. A lot of people just laugh because it's an absurd question. Of course, this culture isn't going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sustainable way of living. And the next question is, if you you don't believe that the cultures can undergo voluntary transformation, then what, and you care about the land where you live, you care about life at all, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is, for the most part, we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't really talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope that there's going to be some magical transformation. And all the environmental activists I know are basically just holding on by the fingernails, doing everything we can to protect this or that scrap of wilderness, in some cases just individual trees, and basically just hanging on, hoping, trying to make it so various creatures can survive until this culture, until civilization collapses, because it can't go on. It won't go on.
Yeah.
I mean, someday we will be living sustainably, and the only question really is what's going to be left of the world when we get there.
I'm really interested in the, I mean, you know, to read your book. I have to confess to our audience that we haven't read your book, but we certainly absorbed the premises. And so I was hoping maybe we could go through some of the premises and discuss some things. Sort of touched on premise number one, that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. And this is especially true for industrial civilization. And premise number three, our way of living is based on, requires, and would collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. And now I just want to sort of offer maybe the typical reaction to that. Many people would say that, wait a minute, it's because of certain aspects of our society, like the cops and the army and the prisons and the judges and whatnot, that we aren't at each other's throats. You know, if it wasn't for the cops, we'd be killing each other. And others still will use the human nature is essentially evil argument, that we've always been violent, we've always waged wars, and that the cops and the prisons and so forth have given us the most peaceful society yet known to man. So how would you respond to that? And exactly sort of what is the type of violence that you're talking about?
Well, there's a bunch. First off, I'm not sure that Iraqis would particularly agree with you right now, but particularly from that perspective. And, you know, the soldiers are keeping peace. And I'm not sure that the salmon would particularly agree either. There's a few things. One of them is that I live on Talawa land, Talawa Indian land, and the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talawa, then they lived here since the beginning of time. And they lived here sustainably the entire time. I mean, they, by definition, I mean, if you live 12,500 years, that's close enough to me for sustainable. And its culture has been here 200 years, and it's, or not, 160 years, and it's trashed. I mean, this area's been hammered. And part of it, I want to go back for just a second to the first premise and talk for just a second about what civilization is, define it. And civilization, I defined as a way of life, and this is going to come back to the violence question. Civilization I've defined as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities, and that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And a city I've defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them, which means that the Talawa weren't civilized, they didn't require the importation of resources. They might trade for something, but they lived within the bounds of what the land base would give them. Anyway, two things happen. One is that your way of life can never be sustainable on a systematic level, on a functional level, because if you're requiring the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll denude another larger area. And the second thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if you require the importation of resources and the people in the next watershed over aren't going to trade you for that resource you need, since you need it, you're going to take it, which means we could all become, you know, just absolutely enlightened, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to get access to all that oil that they need to run the economy? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's on a macro level. On a micro level, this guy stood up at a talk I did a couple years ago, and he said, he asked exactly this question. He said, I don't see violence in my own life. I don't even know what you're talking about. Well, first off, was a guy who said it, not a woman, because there's systematic violence against women in this culture. It's just outrageous. I mean, 25% of all women in this culture are raped in their lifetimes, and 19% send up rape attempts. And, you know, we can talk about that. We can talk about cultures that were very low rape. I mean, the Okanagan of British Columbia had no word in their language for child abuse, and they had a word that did mean the violation of a woman. And what that word literally meant was somebody looked at me in a way I don't like. And there have been and are high rape and low rape cultures, and we can talk about that in a second. But this guy said to me, you know, I don't see any violence. First off, I said, so where's your shirt made? He said, Bangladesh. I said, so do we even need to talk about the violence inherent in your shirt? He said, no. But second off, do you pay rent? And he said, yeah, why? And I said, he said, yeah. And I said, why? He said, because I don't own. I said, well, wait a second. That's what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is, what would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he said, well, I guess the sheriff would come and evict me. And I said, well, what does that mean? What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would come. I said, stop right there. What happens if you invite the sheriff in for dinner, and you have dinner, and then after dinner you say, you know, this was nice, but you're not really that pleasant, so this is my home, and I think you should leave now. He said, well, the sheriff would take out his gun, and he would kick me out of the house. I say, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and take you away. I say, what happens if you get hungry and you go to the grocery store? I saw the food there, you know, and you start eating. And he said, well, they'll call the cops. And I said, yeah, the same sheriff's going to come and take you away. The guy's a real jerk, isn't he? And the point is that we have to pay in order to survive on this planet, in order to, I'm not talking about luxuries, I'm talking about a place to stand, a place to sit, a home. And we also have to pay in order to eat. We have to pay, in that case, it's mainly large corporations. And if we don't, then someone with a gun is going to come and do something to us. And so part of the reason that a lot of us don't see the violence in this is because we're so fully metabolized into the system that we don't... that we go along so much that we don't see the violence, that we don't experience it directly in our bodies. And once again, I'm talking primarily about men, because of course women do every day. And another reason we don't experience it is because we're not at the frontier. And, you know, ask the people of Colombia, ask the people of in the colonies who aren't fully metabolized into the system, who are being forced off their land to, in order to grow coffee, in order to grow whatever cash crops are exported. That's the violence that this system is inherently based on. Once you can ask the salmon. And so as what is a human trait, there are so many accounts of, I mean, one of the reasons that the pilgrims had to kill the Pequot is that there were so many accounts of whites running to join the Indians. Like in the French Indian War, there was a prisoner exchange between the whites and the Indians, and the Indians would run joyfully back to their families, and the whites had to be bound hand and foot not to run back to the Indians. And that happened actually quite often. And this is not, you know, some sort of romantic, savage, you know, nonsense. These are contemporary accounts. You know, Benjamin Franklin, I'm not going to get the line right, but basically Benjamin Franklin said, you know, there are many accounts of whites becoming Indians, but there's not a single account of an Indian becoming white by choice. I'm not saying that every indigenous culture was perfect. What I'm saying is that there have been many indigenous cultures which have been relatively peaceful and relatively non-exploited is what I should say. And that lets us know that it's not an inherent human trait. And we can go off, we've got a lot of ground to cover, so I don't really want to get into this, but Ruth Benedict did this study, I guess I will get into it. Ruth Benedict did this study of why some cultures are good, to use her word, and some cultures are not good. Why some cultures are really violent. Why some cultures are really synergistic, to use her word. Why some cultures treat women poorly, children poorly, have a lot of really outrageous war, and some treat women well, children well. Why is this? And why are some cultures, are people generally unhappy, and why in some cultures are people generally happy? It's not race, it's not gender, it's not house size, it's not richness, poorness. And it's not even patriarchy, which I thought was the root of all evil, but it's not. It's like the root of only half of all evil. But what she found is one simple rule, which is the cultures, the good cultures, recognize that humans are both selfish and altruistic. They're both social creatures, and they're both selfish. And they recognize that, and they meld selfishness and altruism by socially rewarding behavior that benefits the group as a whole, and not allowing behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. And the bad cultures, just consistently, all down the line, would reward, socially reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. And so one of the ways that this could happen is that in many cultures, oh, like in the I never can say this word, XHOSA of South Africa, people are clicking there, if somebody would go kill an animal to eat, then if they didn't share it with everybody, then everybody else would like laugh like a hyena at them. They would shame them. And some of the tribes of the Northwest had a shaming pole that they'd put outside your house. It basically says, I'm a jerk. And so you're not, it all comes down really to how a culture handles wealth. That if a culture handles wealth by praising those who give everything away, and I'm not talking about Warren Buffett because he accumulated in the first place, he was a nasty mean. If the culture rewards generosity, so basically, then everybody's going to be secure. So basically, if I go out fishing and I catch a bunch of fish and I give them to everybody, then everybody says, oh my gosh, Derek, you are so cool. You're the greatest. But if I hoard them or if I try to sell them, everybody says, God, you're a jerk. And they ostracize me. This is what would happen in a healthy family, you know? It's like one person grabs the potatoes and says, nobody's giving any. It's like, what are you doing, Junior? But on the other hand, if you reward the accumulation of wealth, if it's handled through what Ruth Benedict called a siphon system, a funnel system, whereby wealth is constantly funneled from poor to rich, then everybody's going to be insecure. And one of the reasons that you can't just say, okay, well, I'm going to be Mr. Generous or Ms. Generous and, you know, give everything away is because the only way this works is if everybody in your culture is doing it. Because the reason I could go fishing and then give all the fish to everybody in my community is because I know that tomorrow you're going to go, you know, gathering, and then you're going to give all the berries to everybody in the community. It doesn't work if I give everything away and you say thank you very much, and by the way, you want to buy some berries.
Yeah.
And we certainly...
That's where a lot of the violence comes from inherently. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
We certainly do reward over and over again the selfish, the sort of the business person. And we celebrate those characteristics that the business person has, you know, being underhanded and that kind of thing, and being ruthless.
Cold and emotionless.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about different cultures, like which ones work and which ones don't and why. And in one of your premises, you say that the culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. The culture is driven by a death urge and an urge to destroy life. I was just wondering, do we have to go backwards in history, and how far back do we have to go to find cultures that are not somewhat tainted by this kind of insanity?
I think cultures certainly still do exist that are not destroying their land base. And there are cultures that exist that are still in touch with physical reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't really have to go back. And there's also, of course, non-human cultures. There are the salmon. And, I mean, they can all teach us how to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we have to go back that way. But if you're talking about the dominant culture, you know, I don't know. Different people talk about different times when they think it started. There are some who sort of take it from the start of agriculture, and I think that that's a big problem. I don't think it's a problem to say that. I think that agriculture is a big problem. And there are some who start it with the rise of the first cities. And the first written myth, it's pretty interesting, the first written myth of this culture is Gilgamesh going into the forest, the plains and hillsides of Iraq, which were seeded forests so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. That's the first written myth of this culture, and that's a pretty bad start. There are some who take it from, you know, sort of the rise of Judeo-Christianity with, whoever wrote, go forth and multiply. But I think it actually goes further back than that. There's some, like John Zerzan, who take it back to a lot more of symbolic thought and symbolic expression. And I don't know if I take it quite back that far. John and I have had a lot of really good discussions about that. And so basically, I think, systematically at least, we have to take it back to the beginnings of this culture, whatever, you know, whatever sort of insanity began them. Or there's another theory, actually, that I think is really interesting, and this is not... There's a great book called Columbus and Other Cannibals by Jack Forb, and in that book, he suggests... He's American Indian, and in that book, he suggests that the problem is not, you know, that the whole culture is not so much the Ruth Benedict stuff, yeah, that's a problem, but that's a symptom. It's not, you know, that we're also traumatized, that we are incapable of entering into relationships, which is basically what I say in a language older than words. And he says, yeah, that you know, that basically that would be it, but that's a symptom too. What it really is, what he says, which I think is really, really interesting, is a spiritual illness with a physical vector. And what that means, well, I get the flu, and then I've got the flu symptoms, and then I cough, and then, you know, one of you picks up the germ, then you will get the flu symptoms. And he's basically saying that it's an illness like that that causes, you know, if I have the cannibal sickness, and then I cough, or I come in contact with you somehow, then you can become infected with that disease, and you become a cannibal, and you become a capitalist. You have to destroy the soul, consume the souls of others in order to live. And I think, I mean, that's pretty interesting, too. And where, you know, once again, how far back do we have to go before it was here? I don't know.
And do you think that sickness...
I don't know where everything started.
Do you think that sickness is the urge to destroy life that is prevalent in our culture? Would that be the sickness that you're talking about?
Yeah, that would be the sickness that he's talking about. I mean, it's pretty strange. I mean, this whole thing... I just, you know, I've written 9 books about this now, and I still, you know, I can't... We're talking about life on the planet, and... you know, I wonder, do you know what country Angelina Jolie's gonna adopt her next baby from? And Britney Spears just treats her kids so bad. I wonder, you know, the Mets are doing great. I hope they keep it up and make the playoffs. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing. We're only talking about life on the planet here, and... That, you know, but that we talk about, we don't give that the seriousness that it deserves. It's really extraordinary how insane we are in that way.
In your premise 8 for your book Endgame, is the needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. Now, to me, that's a truism. That's something that's, you know, that once I read it, I realized, of course, but that's not how we behave. We behave in the opposite manner.
Oh, yeah.
The economic system is our world religion, and it is everything. And so,
I agree. Where did this
perversion come from, and how can we, I don't know, how do we work against it? Can we even fight against this?
Well, I think it's a perversion that has been sort of pushed from on high, because of course it's in the economic best interest of those in power to get us to internalize that, and that's one of the things you need to do, is to vomit out all their teachings like that. But it's more problematical even than that, because, yes, I totally agree, it's utterly insane. But at the same time, it's really problematical, because not only, you know, are we sort of inculcated into that from the very beginning, inculcated into the notion that non-humans don't exist, that resources exist. I mean, that's one of the things I was talking about, resources. I talk about resources a fair amount, but it's shorthand. But the truth is, resources don't exist. Salmon don't consider themselves a resource, and trees don't consider themselves a resource. They're just salmon, they're trees. And that's really, really important. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you're going to treat them differently. If when I look at this particular tree right here, I see this particular tree right here, I'm going to treat it differently still. And that's true with trees, it's true with fish, it's true with women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'm going to treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. that whole notion of a resource is, I mean, the resources are there to be exploited. So when anybody says that, that's reinforcing this notion that the economic system is more important than the natural world. And I want to say very quickly, and then I'll come back to something else that's really, really important about this, that the fact that salmon aren't resources doesn't mean that we can't eat them. I was doing an interview a few years ago in Spokane, Washington, and the interviewer said, so, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew that answer was kind of crap, but also I'm a male, so I'm required by law to answer every question anybody asks of me. That afternoon, I went out and I sat next to this tree I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. If I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. And everybody knows this. Bears know it, mergansers know it, newts know it, ducks know it.
Huh.
We know it, but we forget. And because if you don't survive. Because if you consume the flesh of the salmon, of the Klamath River salmon, without taking responsibility for their continuation of their community, not in a steward sense, but really in sort of a servant sense, like I'm now, by consuming the flesh of the salmon, of the Klamath River salmon, I'm basically now beholden to them. I'm responsible to them. Responsible, the word means to give in return. And so I am responsible to them. I owe it to them just as I owe it to any of my human friends. And anyway, so that's why, that's one thing. But now back to the other. It's really problematical because we can talk all we want, but the truth is, if my experience is that my water comes from the tap, I will defend to the death the system that brings that to me because my life depends on it. If my experience is, not my philosophy, but if my experience is that my food comes from the grocery store, I will defend to the death the system that brings that food to me because my life depends on it. If, on the other hand, my experience, my reality, is that water comes, my water comes from a river, imagine that, I used to drink from rivers, how quaint is that? And then I will defend to the death that river because my life depends on it. If my experience is that my food comes from a land base, from not a land base, but from this land base, my home, I will defend to the death that land base because my life depends on it. So that's part of the problem, is we've been made dependent on this very system that is killing us. That's a really, really smart trick, which has been intentional, by the way. That's why the dominant culture has to tie up land, has to privatize land. That's why they have to systematically eradicate food stock. Okay, I heard an intake of breath. I want to say one more thing, and then I'll shut up.
It was a laugh.
Oh, okay.
I think it was a giggle.
There was a southern slave owner writing to a northern abolitionist capitalist about defending slavery. He said, look, it doesn't matter whether you own them. That's not the important thing. The important thing is land ownership conditions, because if there's a lot of land and not many people, the only way you can get them to work for you is at the point of a gun, because if they have access to land, then they have access to self-sufficiency. They have access to food, clothing, and shelter. If, on the other hand, there's a lot of people and not much land, they're much better off financially not owning them, because then they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they have to come to you and beg to work for any pittance. So it's been, once again, systematic that the culture has eradicated wild food stocks, has eradicated access to land. Access to land is everything.
This is why we...
Everything.
I think this is a really central point that you're touching on, and it's something that we were discussing last night, is why there is such a difference in reaction with most people. Not me personally, but most people have a different emotional reaction when they see, for example, trees destroyed, or if they see a building destroyed. It's like... A building to people is often a much more of an emotional thing, and if a building is vandalized, so to say, or is destroyed as a political action, people often get much more angrier than when they have the destruction that they see around them constantly and all the time, especially here in British Columbia, where you see clear cuts all the time, everywhere, or you see a natural area being destroyed for a townhouse development, and it's business as usual. It's another day. It's, you know, it could even be the park or the piece of land that you played on for years as a kid, and it's destroyed, and people will be momentarily upset, and then they'll be like, well, that's development.
Buildings mean infinitely more to us than the trees we slaughter to build them with. And how could this be?
Well, I think first off, let's be really, I totally agree with you. Let's be really, really careful about our use of the word us and we.
Yeah.
Because actually buildings aren't more important to me than trees are.
Yeah.
And we're not slaughtering them. Weyerhaeuser is, Max Blow,
Development Company.
Potlatch, Plum Creek, yeah. And it's really important. Like, I got a call from a friend of mine a while ago, and she said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I looked around, and I said, we're in Iraq? I'm like, yeah, we're in Northern California. And she said, Derek, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? And I said, I got troops? Holy crud, will they do what I tell them? Will they, like, if I tell them to take out a gun in Columbia, will they do it? And she's like, you know, Derek, this is why I only call you once every 4 months. And I think it's really, really important that we not identify with the oppressors that way. That we, I mean, there's space aliens who are coming down and, you know, systematically deforesting. You know, I don't think we would be saying we. And by the same token, you know, if they were Islamo-fascist, oh, my God, you know, if the Iraqis invaded the United States, you know, the Iraqis were so close to invading the United States, so close. It's such a good thing that we invaded, isn't it? Oh, no, we didn't. We defended our national interests by invading, sorry. I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah.
You know, if Islamo-fascists were doing the same thing, or Chinese communists, or whoever the enemy of the day is, narco-terrorists, there we go. If they were doing this, then, you know, we would of course resist, but because it's because we sort of systematically are co-opted into saying this we business, then it's so easy to end up not resisting. And if they can get us to say, oh, you know, to identify, oh, we're doing this, we're doing that, that means we're fighting ourselves as well as them. And I think that's really, really important to not do that. So I'm not meaning to jump on you for that.
Oh, no, that's a great point.
No, it's an excellent point, for sure.
And back to your original point about the whole, you know, caring more for buildings than for a land base, I think part of that is, since we've been talking about premise full, which is one of my favorite ones in the book, which is this culture is based on a rigidly defined yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence by those higher in the hierarchy to those lower is often invisible, or when it is seen, it's fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower in the hierarchy, those higher, is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many examples about this. And then the next premise, actually, which has to do with the building thing, is the property of those higher in the hierarchy is worth more than the lives of those below. And those above may destroy the lives of those below, in order to amass more money, and that's called production. And those below, if they damage the property of those above may destroy the lives of those below, and that's called justice.
Yeah, a fantastic example of premise five that we just thought of on the way here is of the case of Jeffrey Lures.
You're fading in and out now. Could you please repeat that?
Yeah.
I couldn't hear you.
A great example of premise five is in the example of Jeffrey Lures, who was convicted of 23 years in prison for burning, I think it was two vehicles on a lot. And that exactly is an example of that. His life, 23 years of his life at least, have been taken away because he dared to destroy two vehicles that belonged to a big company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. The examples are everywhere. There's a guy in Oklahoma who I think beat his wife to death. He didn't beat her to death, it was pretty close, whatever. And he got sentenced to 7 years for that. And somewhere in the process of going through court, he spat on a cop, and for that he was sentenced to life in prison.
So, you're kidding me.
No, it's dead serious. And you see this once again everywhere. It's like, you know, the movie Jaws. Like, I live right near the ocean, still afraid to get in the water because of that stupid movie I saw when I was a teenager. And, you know, I mean, sharks are just scary creatures. And the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is about 20 million to one. Or another great example is there's bears all over the place here. And I love seeing them. There's a baby bear, so cute. My mom says she hasn't seen it yet. My mom lives near me. Anyway, there's a baby bear who the mother bear is bringing it around to show my mom, and the baby bear discovered stairs a couple days ago, and he was so excited. You know, he was like running up and down the stairs then. Anyway, so I live near bears, and I see them quite a bit, and I was like, oh my gosh, isn't that so scary walking through the forest when there's bears around? But there's only one person dies in North America every other year from a bear attack. And on the other hand, there's 46,000 Americans die every year. I shouldn't say Americans, but Canadians. What do I call us? 46,000
North Americans.
United States fascists, should we say? Anyway, no, 46,000 United Statesians die every year because of automobile accidents. So the truth is, you know, everybody says, oh, aren't you afraid of bears? The truth is, we should be terrified when we walk through a parking lot. You know, those are real killers.
Yeah.
This is a huge one for me. Is the amount of people that die in car accidents and on roads. There's always, like you're just saying, trumpeting of different people dying from different causes or even from terrorism or whatever else, and it's like the most risky thing we do is to cover the landscape with roads and drive on in motor vehicles.
It's your fault? You cover the roads? You cover the road?
Right.
It's you.
I've been doing it all along.
yeah, totally. I mean, 9/11 is a great example of that. You know, there's a half a million children die every year as a result of so-called debt repayment. But, you know, when was the last time in the United States that you heard a politician not mention 9/11? I mean, presumably it was probably 9/10, you know? It's like, there's such those particular victims, 3,000 people, there's more people die than that every 2 weeks because of preventable cancers in the United States. Those people don't count. And a really good example, I need to say, this is really, really important, is that this sort of hierarchy of violence, you know, that violence is okay if it flows down but can't flow up, it's so evident, like in abusive family dynamics, that, you know, my father was very violent, and I write about the language of all the words. He beat up everybody in my family but me. He raped my sister, my mom, and me. And the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time. Because he had committed blasphemy, he'd tend violence up the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that. And that's one of the problems that a lot of pacifists have, is that the truth is they so totally buy into this notion that you can't stand it up a hierarchy. And it's blasphemy to stand it up. And another example of this is cops. Between 4 and 6 Americans, between 4 and 6 United Statesians die every day because they encounter police. But on the other hand, every time a cop dies, it's a big state funeral. You know, some gave all gave some. Because you know what the most dangerous civil service profession in the United States is? Garbage collection. It's way more dangerous than being a cop. but when was the last time you saw a big state funeral for a garbage collector, you know?
and this is
because they don't push that violence down the hierarchy. Sorry, go ahead.
It's a great example in current events right now is the situation in Israel, where you have 3 Israeli soldiers killed and 2 taken prisoner, and nobody's really talking about the fact that just days earlier, 23 people in Gaza were killed, 5 of those were children, 1 of them was a mother, and that the violence, I mean, there's tons of examples, but that had just happened, and that also the retaliation for these 2 soldiers being taken prisoner is to bomb all kinds of targets in Lebanon. And of course the situation is way more complicated, and I don't want to get into it, but that the fact of it is that the retaliation for these 2 soldiers, it says explicitly the lives of all those civilians that are dying are less valuable than the soldiers that were taken prisoner or killed.
And I think, again, it's like the same as you were saying, Derek, that it's violence up the hierarchy, right? It's this small sort of upstart group who is daring to perpetrate violence on the Israeli army, who they're allowed to do that because, hey, they're an army, you know?
Exactly.
I think another premise that I'd like to just get into before we're running out of time is one of our favorites as well. Oh, yeah, premise 14, actually, I really personally related to is that from birth onwards, we're individually and collectively enculturated to hate life, to hate the natural world, hate wild animals, hate women, hate children, hate our bodies, hate and fear our emotions, and hate ourselves. If we did not hate the world, we could not allow it to be destroyed before our eyes. If we did not hate ourselves, we could not allow our homes and our bodies to be poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's brilliant. I don't even know if it, if I have a question about it, but I really...
I think you touched on it already with the Jaws and the bears, that we're scared.
Well, and there's another part of that, too, which is I used to have this habit of asking people to like their jobs, and with 90% saying no. And what does it mean that the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do?
Mm.
And I wrote another book called Walking on Water, Reading, Writing, and Revolution, which is about education. And that book is fundamentally about, it starts with a question of, I think the first two lines are this true for most people I know? I've always loved learning. Also, is this true for most people I know? I always hated school. Why is that? And what I realized, you know, when I was in high school, I used to think that I recognize even in junior and high school, if they could teach all the material that they teach you in junior and high school and elementary through K through 12, they could teach you the material in, I don't know, gosh, probably 4 or 5 years. Because once you learn, you know, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, negative numbers, decimals, what do you really learn in math until algebra? And it's the same with, you know, once they teach you the basic lies in history, you know, everything else is crazy. And once they teach you in science that the world consists of objects to be exploited or to be studied, you know, what do they really teach you? I mean, that's it. And so I thought when I was in junior high and high school that the reason school takes so long is because they were trying to break you the habit of daydreaming. Because, you know, I sat in the back of class just lining rockets over the left field fence and winning the World Series for... You know, it's really boring to win a World Series about 35 times a day, and, you know, to win the, you know, the football championship and the NBA championship and all that. You know, I won every Olympic event, you know, like 5,000 times, and it gets really boring. But then I finally realized that the real reason that school takes that long is that children don't give up their wills easily, and it takes that long to break their wills sufficiently to prepare them for lives of painful employment. And, you know, people talk about technology in the classroom, and I think the single most important piece of technology in the classroom is the second hand and the clock. And the purpose is to teach all the students the same prayer, which is, please, God, make this thing move faster. And that's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. And my point is that we are systematically, in every way, taught to be absent from our experience and taught to be subservient to these external authorities who don't have our best interests at heart. I don't have a problem with authority, and I don't have a problem I don't have a problem with earned authority. It's like, I used to go hunting when I lived in Spokane, and not sport hunting, I mean hunting for food, and don't worry, like if you're animal rights people, don't worry, because I was a terrible hunter. I was a great hunter, but just like a deer. The only thing I ever got was lost. And the guys I went with were really, really, really good hunters, and when we hang out and just do something else, then it's fine. It's all egalitarian. But when we went hunting, they told me what to do. And my point is that they were tremendously experienced. And the thing, you know, if we were to talk about, you know, writing or something, then I would be the authority. You know, I could give them advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so once again, I don't have a problem with authority, but I have a huge problem with an authority who doesn't have my best interest at heart, who is training me for... I took a walk yesterday with one of the neighbors, and we were talking about another neighbor who just quit teaching in public school, and I was asking why, and it was because she so hates the fact that they don't actually teach anything. All they do is get them ready for tests. And, you know, we can talk about that, or we can talk about how women are enculturated to hate their bodies. No, it's all of a piece, and it's all about being absent from your own experience, because if we were in our experience, if we were paying attention to the fact that we're working jobs we hate, or that we are in the midst of, you know, I ask people, and I talk, they say, how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? And about 80% say yes. And cancer, of course, is a disease of civilization. I have Crohn's disease, a disease of civilization. We are systematically being poisoned. And if you're not going to fight back when they poison your own body, if you're not going to fight back, you have to walk day by day past clear cuts. you know, what exactly is it going to take?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer, of course, is, I'm sorry, go ahead. What do you say that the cliffhanger? I'm about to read the book. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I'm just going to say, well, we don't have a lot of time left, and there are still some things that certainly I really want to touch on.
Should we just do it again on time?
Well, we could do that, or we could. I would certainly like to do that. I would like to talk about two things here. I think premise 15 and then 17. Premise 15. You sort of touched on this, and then we moved on, that love does not imply pacifism.
Oh, thank you so much for bringing that up. Okay.
So, maybe you could elaborate on that and discuss that a little.
I get this a lot. It's like, gosh, Derek, you know, if you just had enough love in your heart, that, you know, if you just love the CEOs enough, you know, cause you could never even think about fighting back. Because obviously, if you're angry, you have some hate, and so you obviously don't love. And I think that that's really wrong. Love doesn't imply pacifism, and I think Mother Grizzly Bears are going to back me up on this one.
I often think of that as well when I think about this issue.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in the country, and in my life, I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, hummingbirds, mice, spiders, chickens, geese. Oh my gosh, geese.
Spiders.
Because they thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse will take on somebody 6,000 times her size, you know, what is wrong with us? And so, no, love doesn't imply pacifism. I actually wrote Endgame in the first place because one of the reasons I wrote it is because when I do talk about the question of fighting back, the response by the audience is really predictable. And that sort of mainstream activists and peace and social justice activists and pacifists in general would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield. But they just say Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama again and again as fast as they can to keep evil thoughts at bay. And then the grassroots activists would kind of do the same thing, but then it would come up to me afterwards in private, and I would say, thank you for bringing this up. And then an entirely different group of people, like prisoners and family farmers and American Indians and a lot of the really poor and a lot of people of color and certainly survivors of domestic violence, would look at me like, so tell us something we don't know. Come on, let's go, bro. And I thought a lot about that difference. And the difference is that for those latter groups, violence is not some sort of theoretical question to be puzzled through. It's a spiritual question to be dealt with. It's not, violence is not turned into, it's not mystified and turned into this big thing. Instead, it's just part of life and you deal with it. That doesn't mean you do it. It doesn't mean you don't do it. It means you just deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting because pacifism is really a cult. And it's a cult like Christianity that cannot allow any heresy. It's like not only I have no problem with somebody who doesn't want to fight back themselves. There's plenty of work to be done. That's one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. But one of the problems is that pacifists not only can they not deal with it themselves, but they can't let anybody else even think about it. And they always drop these cliches. And I got so sick of responding to cliches that I wanted to just write up this and go through every one of the cliches, like, you can't use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house. Well, okay, first off, Audre Lorde is a great writer and a great thinker and everything else. And A, she wasn't talking about pacifism. And B, I can also tell she never wore construction because it doesn't matter whose tools you use. It's a terrible metaphor. You know, you can use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house. You can use your cousin's tool to dismantle the master's house. It doesn't matter. That implies that violence is one of the master's tools. And those in power are trying to tell us that they own the land. They're trying to tell us they own the water. They're trying to tell us that they own methods of conflict resolution called law. They're trying to tell us they own everything else. And now you're going to try to tell me that they own violence too? Those in power do not own violence. It is not one of their tools. It is just all you have is you don't have, and there's no master's house. There's a house, there's tools, use them or not, whatever. And once again, I think Mother Grizzly Bears are going to back me up that those in power do not own violence. And so I went through, you know, you can talk about violence doesn't accomplish anything. Oh, my God, that makes me so mad. Violence doesn't accomplish anything? Gosh, so does that mean all those Africans just jumped on the ship and said, hey, we want to go over to America and work in cotton fields? And did all the Native Americans, did they go, you know, I think we're going to give you our land because your way of living is so much better than ours. I mean, violence doesn't accomplish anything. There's a great line by Robin Morgan. Obviously, this gets me energized. There's a great line by Robin Morgan. She says, anywhere, anytime, anywhere in the world, a woman can be walking alone on the street. And if she hears footsteps behind her, she has reason to be afraid. And she calls that the democracy of fear. Do not tell me, I know you didn't, so I'm not getting mad at you, do not tell me that violence doesn't accomplish anything. Violence has, systematic violence against women has changed the behavior of half the human population. Don't tell me that violence doesn't accomplish anything. Violence accomplishes a lot. It's just that the only ones who can use it are those in power.
And
so yeah, we can go through, I've got all those arguments. Hey, sorry, go ahead.
As you point out in one of your early premises, actually, our entire way of living is supported and based on and created by violence. So if violence doesn't cause anything, then this doesn't, or, you know, industrial civilization doesn't exist. Which, of course, it does.
That's brilliant. I never thought of that. Thank you. That's great.
Are you sure?
Right.
I thought it was you that thought of that.
What?
I thought it was you that thought of that.
No, that wasn't. I never made that connection. That's great. So you know what that means? All we have to do, oh my God, I did an interview a couple of days ago, and this guy calls up and says, you know what the real answer is? The real answer, oh God, I can't even say this in face. The real answer is that we all need to meditate every day at noon. We all need to sit down. I guess it's probably noon Pacific time. Every day at noon, we all need to sit down and we need to meditate. Peace before me, peace behind me, peace above me, peace below me.
Peace to the left and peace to the right. Sorry?
Oh yeah, peace to the left and peace to the right. Sorry. Yeah, you have to do it all around, otherwise it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So that's why we haven't been able to stop civilization yet, is because I kept forgetting to meditate peace to the left and peace to the right. That's my fault. You trip off of the road, it's my fault for not meditating right. You know, it's like, if we can just get everybody to meditate, then things are going, well, geez, if we're going to fantasize about getting everybody to meditate, why don't we fantasize about getting everybody to take out the dam?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry,
No, I agree. I mean, I do think it would be nice if everybody was would be thinking that way. But if we could get everybody to meditate at 12 noon on peace, then we wouldn't need to do that because everybody would be already dismantling the dams and the whole infrastructure.
Right. I mean, the question that's really wonderful. But what are you going to do when somebody is standing in front of you? Beating a child.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to go up and I'm going to compassionately say, you know, I'm sorry, sir, could you please meditate about peace before you peace? That's like, that's crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you stop the perpetrator. That's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think...
Well, except that's what we don't do, which is why there's still 2 million dams standing in the United States.
I think I personally really relate to the issue of love not implying, not necessarily being... love does not imply pacifism as a new mother myself, because I'm always chewing over the issue of pacifism and what it means and all this kind of stuff. And once you become a mother, I think you very much understand why it doesn't imply pacifism. Because, I mean, you imagine all kinds of scenarios in which something could happen to your child and you realize that there's, like, it's your responsibility. You have this helpless being that is in your care, and it is your utmost responsibility to do absolutely everything in your power to defend that being by all means necessary. And of course that extends to the macrocosm of the earth.
Yep. You know, exactly. I mean, the best thing you can do for your child is stop the systematic poisoning of your child's bloodstream.
Mm.
It's pretty interesting also, the whole thing about mothers defending their children is, I don't remember which group it was, but there were some indigenous peoples in sort of northeastern United States, I don't remember who it was, that the women were in charge, but basically, it was matrifocal, but the women couldn't be in charge until after they reached menopause, and that was an acknowledgement of the fact that when they have young children, they they would basically, if anybody hurts their little baby's pinky finger, you know, it's like, okay, let's kill all of them. You know, they would respond very strongly, and they wouldn't necessarily respond. They would respond most to defend the child as opposed to always having the best interest of the group. And so, I mean, it's great, and it's wonderful, and they recognize that. And so then once they're past menopause, and once they're not going to have young children, then they start running the whole group. And I thought it was really interesting.
Hmm.
And pretty smart, frankly.
Hmm. We should probably... we need to wrap up now, but I think we would certainly like to continue this again. We would like to let our listeners know how they can go about getting your books. You've written a number of books. We've actually ordered all of them.
I did contact the local bookstore here at the mall, Faulkner's Books, and they were able to order pretty much every one of them. So that is a possibility for people. And can they also go online to find out more information?
Yeah, they can. I mean, obviously they're available at bookstores everywhere, and they can also get them from my website, and they can also get more information on my website. There's two websites. One is derrickjensen.org, DerrickJensen.org, and there's also a place where we have some excerpts from the book, and that website is called endgamethebook.org, endgamethebook.org. And we've got excerpts there and various other stuff. Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks for your questions. And I would be happy to come back on. Just let me know when.
Awesome. Just stay on the line, and we'll talk to you afterwards. But thank you very much for being on the show, Derrick.